very much from Champagne. I hope I can live up to it. Topic is presidential power. And the other day, discussing it with a colleague of mine, a distinguished economist, who was, several years ago, one of the leading inside experts in the White House, I asked him for some suggestions on what I should say, specifically about the rise of the staff man, the specialist, the insider in the White House. I was thinking, I must confess, of people like John Ehrlichman, that ilk. And this friend of mine, who was in the Nixon administration, who was a rather important figure, said that during his time there, it wasn't so much that he thought that a lot of the people who seemed to be on their way to jail right now were stupid. His problem was he wasn't quite sure what they were doing in the White House. And he paused for a moment and he said, well, now I know what they were doing. Well, this session in general is called The Best of Times and the Worst of Times. I suppose it's a phrase that well sums up the conservative's predicament at the present moment, the conservative's dilemma, when he thinks specifically of the presidency, specifically of a president who is considered, for better and worse, to be our president, to be the conservative president. Richard Nixon is a man who most conservatives were not terribly enthusiastic about in the first place. Most of them voted for him, many of them campaigned for him. He is ultimately, I suppose, a man who we were with, but he was not of us. And as I muse upon our predicament and perhaps the futility of the conservatives' vocation in life, especially in America these days, I'm reminded once again of that famous line penned by the judicious Richard Hooker, perhaps the greatest of the Carolingian divines, when he wrote toward the end of his sermon on civil obedience in his book, The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity. He wrote that I set these words down that men may know that I have not loosely through silence allowed these things to pass away as in a dream. And I suppose if there is any purpose for our being here, any purpose for us continuing the kinds of discussions that we continue over the year, it is for that reason, that men may know that we have not loosely through silence allowed these things to pass away as in a dream. Well, my topic today, and what I will attempt to say some things about, hopefully with a degree of sense, is simple. In the light of recent history, can conservatism, or more specifically, since I don't believe it is possible to speak of conservatism, I think one ultimately, if one is historically trained, can only speak of conservatisms, and more on that later, can conservatism, post-war American conservatism, and its movement hope to prevail? Specifically, can conservatives hope to elect a conservative president, or rather can a conservative, broadly defined, to include people ranging from a Barry Goldwater and a Ronald Reagan to a Richard Nixon, or a quasi-conservative, like, say, Nelson Rockefeller, and I'm perfectly willing to debate that, first win the Republican or the Democratic nominations, without first chucking certain essential aspects of his conservatism, and if elected, and I suppose this is ultimately the real crunch, can a conservative remain conservative, or at least quasi-conservative, and hope, A, to be a successful president, to get things through with Congress, and then get reelected? Now, cephalological data and the machinations of the pollsters, the public opinion pollsters, suggest that this ought to be a pretty simple task. All available evidence, and one need only study voting patterns and muse upon some of the opinion polls that get thrust before us every couple of years, indicate that we are a pretty conservative nation, that liberalism, i.e. social democracy, which Americans call liberalism, is not all that popular. Recently, Kevin Phillips and Albert Sindlinger, recently being last week, published a poll which Phillips entitled The Swing from Liberalism. And in that poll, Phillips noted that despite the negative impact of Watergate, the American public is continuing to move in a more conservative ideological direction away from its longtime preference for New Deal, Fair Deal, and New Frontier liberalism. He wrote, the growing concern about energy, the economy, by intensifying the self-preoccupation and money-saving proclivities of the electorate, seems to be increasing the trend away from yesterday's economically-based liberalism. These were the findings that he found, that conservatives, in his public opinion poll, make up, and this was a public opinion poll, I hasten to add, that was based on 2,576 telephone interviews around the country over the last month. The conservatives make up 34% of the U.S. population, moderates 41%, and liberals, a small minority of just 18%. About one-third of those persons questioned by Phillips, who now regards himself as a moderate or a conservative, once claimed to be liberals and had shifted their beliefs. He concludes his opinion poll and his findings by saying 35% of all Democrats admitted to having abandoned liberal beliefs, by the heaviest ratio of ideological apostasy occurred in the independent groups. 41% admitted to being ex-liberals. Even in the GOP, where it was never strong to begin with, liberalism has lost ground. To underscore the trend away from liberalism, the shift away from conservative thinking is slight and centers in a few affluent areas of the Northeast, Great Lakes, and Pacific Coast. A small percentage of the U.S. liberal contingent is made up of men and women in their 20s and 30s, many from upper middle class backgrounds who are former conservatives, usually Republicans. In contrast, most apostate liberals come from less prosperous backgrounds and live in the Southwest. So far, this shift of ideological thinking among the American electorate has resulted less in realignment of the two major parties than in their ultimate decomposition. Well, that's what the opinion pollsters say, but of course, as we know, and this is just one opinion poll, recently there was also another poll of, for example, voters in New York City by George Gallup, which saw a tremendous swing toward conservatism there. Well, as many of you who supported Barry Goldwater in 1964 will recall, and this is one of the tricky things about polls, there was a series of polls by Gallup and Harris in 1964 where people were asked what their position was on a whole series of thorny issues, and invariably those questioned opted for conservative solutions, conservative positions, the positions being advocated in 1964 by Barry Goldwater. But when confronted with the question as to who they were going to vote for, they said they were going to vote for Lyndon Johnson, who they perceived as being more conservative than Barry Goldwater. So this, again, has to do with this problem, can a conservative be elected? Now, before going any further, perhaps I should say a few things about what I mean by conservative. I think of all the labels, of all the terms that we use, and this is why I use the word conservatism, ideologically in the 20th century, this is one of the most difficult to come to grips with. Conservatism, unlike Marxism or classical liberalism, has no real intellectual provenance. It's more of a style of thinking than a logos of ideas. There's no party line. Coupled with the fact that the conservatism changes constantly from period to period, and I think the changing nature of conservatisms is one of the most perplexing aspects, aside from the ideological aspect, of these movements, of these phenomena. They vary, as I say, from era to era, from situation to situation, and from country to country. The things which, for example, a French conservative or a Canadian conservative may wish to conserve are invariably quite different from the things an American conservative wishes to conserve. Post-war American conservatism, for example, in its initial, admittedly vulgar period, assumed that anybody who was pro-American was a conservative, which of course made room for leaders of the British Labour Party and locked out a number of leading European and Canadian conservatives. There was a comment that was made several years ago by a German historian trying to come to grips with which is which, having read in the Petit Les Russes, for example, that conservatives and parties of the right are the least advanced parties and the most advanced parties are the parties of the left. He tried to find out who the conservatives were. His name is Eugen Weber. And he asks, did Perón, who of course when he wrote this was not in Argentina, did Perón belong to the right because he was a dictator, or to the left because much of his power rested on the unions? Is a nationalistic dictator like Nasser of the right, or does his radicalism, his reformism, place him on the left? Does dictatorship automatically classify a man, a party, a regime as being of the right? And if so, what do we do about Stalin or Tito? Does radicalism and revolution provide an automatic definition of the left? or does it allow for a Kemal Ataturk or a Nasser? We see there can be revolutions of the left and the right, dictatorships of the left and the right, planned economies of the left and the right, and obviously totalitarianism of the left and the right. Can we find the criterion of the left in its popular appeal, its reliance on universal suffrage? But the most reactionary demagogues rely on popular appeal, and plebiscitarian dictatorships like that of Napoleon III, like that of Hitler, rest on universal suffrage, as many conservative regimes have done. We know at least, or think we know, that the left tends toward change and the right to conserve. This puts Ataturk on the left with Hitler and Porfirio Diaz, and Franco, Baldwin, Salazar, Poincaré, and Churchill in the same right-wing basket. Well, I quote that only to indicate some of the problems that are raised when one tries to come to grip with anything as difficult as the history of conservatism or conservatisms in general. Many of the issues that we consider to be conservative today, like, for example, nationalism or liberalism, the liberal aspect of contemporary conservatism, were considered to be, in their origins, to be rather progressive movements. For example, in the 18th century, when statesmen began contemplating replacing traditional authoritarian monarchical forms of government with governments deriving their power from the people, they viewed their decision to do so as a means of A, increasing nationalism, and B, making themselves appear as a progressive movement. Nationalism is in effect a relatively new historical phenomenon. The same thing with liberalism. In fact, I think it's one of the most interesting things to me is that if one were to survey, for example, the Latin American and the Iberian and the French left during the early 20th century, and you would ask them who their heroes were, you would find that they were people like George Washington, Adam Smith, the people who we consider today, and this has again to do with the changing nature of conservatism, that every age wishes to conserve different things, to be people that we as American conservatives look back to with a degree of warmth, to say the least. Now, in its vulgar, almost Oakeshottian sense, the raison d'etre of conservatism, historically, is opposition to radical change. In some extreme forms, it may be opposition to change, period. It has historically been a movement of opposition in the parliamentary sense. It has rarely been a majoritarian movement, since those periods when men of conservative bent are in agreement with the status quo are rare, and generally, I must confess, quite dull. And during such periods, such individuals merely, again, in the Oakeshottian sense, accept the zeitgeist. They're like Burke's sleeping cows or sleeping cattle under the English oaks, immune to the insects of revolutionary change. Conservatisms are reactive ideologies, since they only become significant in periods of crisis, when the ideological divisions are fairly rigid, when people tend to take sides and to change sides. That's when we notice a conservative. That's when he rouses himself from a kind of acquiescent presentism to the shedding of ink, to the writing of manifestos. He reacts to a series of crises. In modern history, one thinks of those moments when we've most noticed conservatism, and they've been periods of crises and the periods that followed immediately after them, like the French Revolution, for example, in our own century, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, most recently the Vietnam War, are periods when the lines were clearly drawn. And again, we notice a conservative movement, and indeed people begin to embrace that movement coming over from other sides. Usually, in these periods, and again, I'm using this Oakeshottian presentist of concept of conservative as somebody who wishes to conserve the status quo, it is in times like these, in times of crisis, that the conservative is less likely to be a conservative and more likely to be a reactionary, a counter-revolutionary. Conservative is hence a man of crises. In such times, as I say, when the ideological lines are drawn, he reacts, sheds ink. But American conservatism is different in many ways. And one of the things that makes it different is its propensity to avoid reactionary responses. This is not to say that it's not a reactionary tradition in America. There have been significant reactionary thinkers in America since the days of the Revolution. But the American conservative, like his British cousin, has a strong empirical side. And I think it's here that we begin to come to grips with somebody like, for example, Richard Nixon. Michael Pinto-Duszynski, in his work on empirical conservatism in Britain, has noted that conservatives have traditionally shown an aversion to systematic thought, and he is speaking about 19th century to 20th century British conservatism, which has in its own way influenced American conservatism, priding themselves in their empiricism. It had been said, for example, of Lord Salisbury, the Prime Minister in the 19th century, perhaps the most profound intellectual among the British Tory Prime Ministers of the 19th century, that the greater number of the principles by which he was guided were essentially utilitarian in character and founded on what may be called the higher expediency. There were but few of them for which he would have admitted any independent thought or permanent existence apart from the circumstance in which they operated. And in general, conservatives in the British tradition and in the post-industrial revolution tradition in America have tended to fit into this. It must be conceded, too, that, for example, a man in 19th century British politics, like, for example, Peel, even more than Salisbury, was guided by principles which were essentially utilitarian. One could say the same about Disraeli. And I've always liked the comment made about Peel by Lord Cecil in his sadly out of print book on British conservatism, which I think is a classic insight into the kind of empirical conservatism devoid of romanticism, devoid of dreaming for a golden age that still afflicts, for example, French and Canadian and continental conservatism to this day. He wrote of Cecil, he says, "As long as Ireland could be governed without granting emancipation, he resisted it. As long as he could work the fiscal administration of the country without repealing the Corn Laws, he defended them. But the conversion to which no abstract argument could lead him was at once asserted by the logic of the fact, impending civil war in Ireland and actual famine there, did what no reflection on religious liberty or freedom of trade would have ever done." Well, that is what the British mean by empiricism, and in a certain sense, that is what a man like Richard Nixon means. He veers from what many American conservatives, many post-war American conservatives, consider to be the conservative line. There is no conservative line. There are a series of vague principles that some of us accept and some of us reject. Some people in the strange hodgepodge of American conservatism harken back to the old liberalism of the 18th and 19th centuries. Others harken back to a kind of Kirkian-Burkeanism, if you will. And the end result is very little agreement. So Richard Nixon, in a certain sense, is safe on those grounds. American conservatism, and this is a problem that I have when I talk about it to Americans, is devoid of the kind of anthropological pessimism that pervades, say again, French or Spanish conservatism. He's not particularly concerned about the political significance of original sin. He doesn't necessarily believe that man is corrupt by nature. He is rather suspicious of the strong central government. These are all things that would personify a classical continental conservative, somebody like Salazar, for example, who was one of the names mentioned by Eugen Weber. And certainly your classical conservative, rather, his roots are, for better and worse, in the Enlightenment. In a certain sense, all of us, whether we like it or not, are children of the Enlightenment. The conservative, specifically in America, is a child of the old classical liberalism. The old classical liberalism, which had essentially three aspects to it, a philosophical, an economic, and a political, the first resting upon the general Stoic belief that all men are created equal. In this sense, I should point out that this view differs from the classical democracy, which recognized only citizens as being equal. The economic aspect, founded on the laissez-faire of the Scottish Enlightenment, and the political meaning, which is derived from the liberal doctrines of people like John Locke, Montesquieu, John Stuart Mill, and so on and so forth. Respectively, this tradition stresses the belief that government exists for the well-being of the people, that power must be checked by power, and that freedom of the person, freedom of speech, freedom of the marketplace, of press, and so on and so forth, are essential to make all these ends meet. This, of course, is the classical liberalism. And I suppose when one talks about the plight of conservatism in America, in a certain sense, one is talking not about the plight of something that Edmund Burke would have understood, or the plight of something that Dr. Salazar in Portugal would have understood. One is talking about the plight of this classical, humane, liberal view that prevailed and was personified by somebody like Adam Smith. Now, what was the view of liberalism? The term was used right up until the end of the 19th century in America by people in both the Democratic and Republican parties. And even then, you had a left-wing and a right-wing of the Democratic and Republican Party. They meant precisely what I have said that classical liberalism meant. It was slightly more authoritarian than, let's say, the views of Murray Rothbard, but pretty close. Now, about the time when the social Darwinists begin to go on the wane, a number of things seem to happen to the liberal ethos in America. And I'll simply sketch out some vague ideas on how this ideology changed. Liberalism was thrown on the defensive, an ideology or worldview that was, and it came into being as part of the Enlightenment, and found itself put on the defensive by the Industrial Revolution, for example, and a whole series of historical developments coming from the Industrial Revolution, extreme social problems, poverty, slums, and the like. And an ideology that advocated things like laissez-faire was easily depicted in the press and in the academy as a kind of cruel ideology. The interesting thing is how the name was appropriated by people who had very little interest in this ideology, who did not subscribe to its tenets. And I suspect that the first major politician, for example, to use the term, Woodrow Wilson, was using it primarily because it had a nice ring to it. The term liberal had a nice ring to it, and the term liberal in the early years of the 20th century, the late 19th century, had been somehow vulgarized by the term social Darwinist. And when, if you ask a man like William Graham Sumner, for example, what a liberal was, he would say, well, he's a social Darwinist. It sounded more scientific, more 19th century, more modern at the time. Well, in any event, the term liberal, I suspect, became somehow vulgarized by the Protestant effort, by our own innate belief in our ability, we are chosen people, God's elect, we are the best country in the world, and of course this is all available in the writings of Woodrow Wilson. And the view that where there is an American government of will, there must be an American government of way, both home and abroad, comes to dominate the thinking of our politicians, eventually in both parties, primarily in the Democratic Party, to the point where we find ourselves in the days of Camelot in the 1960s. Now, it's slightly more than a decade since the 1,000 days of the Kennedy administration passed, I suppose tragically, into the annals of history because of the way they passed, and the rhetoric of those tumultuous days, which I feel was the rhetoric of dying ideology, of this messianic ideology gone wrong, personified by the young president's very fanatical inaugural address, has ossified, I think, leaving many Americans, including Americans on the left, with a vague memory of reckless bravado gone wrong. The Arthurian legend of the Camelot laws propagated by the regime's numerous hagiographers has, I think, long since ceased to move the multitudes, as it did in months and years immediately following Dallas. The adulation is also gone, and even from the vantage of Watergate, it is now difficult to think of the new frontier as anything but a disaster of the first order. The narrow historical revisionism, I think it's only surprising that it lasted as long as it did. Americans came to believe during the New Frontier that there is not necessarily an American government away where there is an American government will, that intervention, at least abroad, doesn't always work. Michael Novak has recently commented in reviewing the latest confession of Arthur Schlesinger Jr. That the right worries about the imperial presidency at home and the left worries about it abroad. And I think there's a certain amount of truth to that. In any event, during the period, roughly from Wilson to the present, presidential power increased tremendously. There was a move in that direction in the 19th century, but it was always stymied by the growth of strong congresses. There are these periods in the 19th century after the age of Jackson where we have very strong legislatures and very weak executives. And I suspect that after the Civil War, had Congress succeeded in impeaching Andrew Johnson, a Franklin Roosevelt, for example, would have been inconceivable. And the executive and our approach to the executive and understanding the executive power would have been profoundly altered by that development. In any event, the striking thing about the new American liberalism was its meddling aspect and its belief in the significance of the presidential leader, his ability to, in Henry Fairley's phrase, to make politics tempting, to transcend politics itself. Henry Fairley has said of John F. Kennedy, and I think this is one of the best statements I've seen on a messianic liberal president, that he promised not only that politics could transcend the normal political processes of the country, but that spectacular personal leadership could itself transcend politics. He exalted in himself the power of the state. He made a connection between power and excellence from which the American people have not yet extricated themselves. Every individual aspiration was politicized as he appeared before the American people like a Byzantine emperor, sheathed in gold, suspended between heaven and earth, interceding with the divine majesty on their behalf. Now, liberalism of the New Deal, the New Frontier, and the redoubtable Great Society was predicated upon what Robert Nesbitt calls the redemptive possibilities of political power. For Kennedy and his mentors, particularly those doyens of the old American liberalism of yore, Neustadt, Schlesinger Jr., and Burns, what FDR would have done with those names, incidentally, government appeared as a vast reservoir of power which, in Michael Oakeshott's phrase, inspired them to dream of what use might be made of it. Like Oakeshott's adventurous government man, Kennedy sought to capture the source of political power and, if necessary, to increase it so as to impose policies on his fellows that would, he believed, benefit mankind as a whole. His intentions were eudaimonic, his predilections redemptive, his methods dirigistic, and his ultimate failure, I think, calamitous. Mankind derived virtually no benefits from Kennedy's abbreviated tenure in the White House. He left most Americans with nothing but a sense of frustration and promises unfulfilled, and the knowledge that under his stewardship, government had become an instrument of passion rather than a restraining, moderating force of reconciliation. We have not yet, alas, regained our equilibrium, a fact that has become more and more obvious in recent months. But it is Kennedy's foreign policy, not his domestic failures, emphasizing his Novakian thesis, that the new revisionists, that people have begun to suspect the implications of liberalism, hold against it. In particular, of course, the war in Vietnam. Now, it is interesting to note, in the wake of the Vietnam adventure, our greatest adventure, as Hubert Humphrey once euphorically described it in one of his more impudicitous verbal eruptions, the American public, or that portion of the American public that pays attention to such things, is being subjected to a great deal, I think, of idle and sipid chatter concerning the desirability of reappraising our international priorities. It is not so much that the old priorities were all that good, but they clearly were not. It is that the alternatives that these people are proposing seem quite often to be so unrealistic. It is very interesting to see that the vanguard of the new criticism of liberal foreign policy, at least, is being conducted by people like Hubert Humphrey and the Washington Post, which you may remember went at least half the way with LBJ and our involvement in Vietnam, and indeed the best and the brightest, which includes, I suppose, Daniel Ellsberg, who are one of the greatest critics of this, the hawks of yesteryear, as it were. Perhaps someday somebody should write a book called Where Are the Hawks of Yesteryear. Now, the interesting thing, if one simply studies the consistency of conservative thought in the 20th century on the growth of presidential power, specifically in the area of foreign affairs, not simply in domestic affairs, one finds that the conservative politicians already, in the days of Woodrow Wilson, a man like Henry Cobbett Lodge the Elder, for example, recognized very strongly the direction in which big government was taking us, the direction in which a messianic domestic and foreign policy was taking us. And we find this right down the line. There are a series, just as everybody believes that this great liberal world is bringing us into eudaimonia, there are a series of very influential conservatives in Congress who are railing against the dangers of an increased presidential power, specifically increased presidential war-making power, but also some of the so-called domestic reforms of the New Deal. And these are people, as I say, like Robert Taft and Henry Cabot Lodge, the Elder, would be two very good ideal types of this. And of course, for making these criticisms, if one goes back to the New York Times and the Washington Post in the 1950s and see the way they treated Robert Taft for his criticisms of our involvement in the Korean War, the same people that are now lionizing, for example, Fulbright, were the same people who were damning Robert Taft at this point. Conservatives remain fairly consistent, but something happened along the way. And this again gets back to this thorny problem of conservatism. I would suspect that by the time John F. Kennedy delivered that messianic inaugural address, where he in effect promised to liberate the world, there were very few people who would have disagreed with it. certainly very few conservatives. I think that when he made that speech, he was speaking for the consensus. He was speaking for Barry Goldwater and William Fulbright. That at least in international affairs, by the late 40s, most American conservatives had been converted to liberal interventionism, at least in terms of foreign policy. The isolationism that had personified American conservatism before the war was finished. But as I said, and this admittedly, and I apologize, somewhat rambling and not properly organized talk, one of the most interesting, one of the most oddest aspects of the change that has taken place in liberalism, I think personified by the fact that very few people like to call themselves liberals anymore, is, for example, the recent writings of people who once advocated this messianic liberalism. Most specifically, I think, of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., I think himself a monument, an intellectual monument, to what he now calls the uncritical cult of the activist presidency. And we now find people like Schlesinger Jr., and specifically Schlesinger Jr., voicing the exact same kinds of objections to the shift in the constitutional balance regarding the presidency that conservative writers, like, for example, James Burnham, was writing about the late 40s and early 50s. You will recall that Burnham, in his Congress in the American Tradition, complained that the New Deal and what had followed in its wake had appropriated powers reserved for the by the Constitution and by prescriptive practice to the Congress. This was a great theme, I think, among conservative writers during the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, when we'd only open the pages in National Review to find these arguments that Congress ought to have more say in the running of government. However, again, as I emphasize, where Burnham concentrated and where conservatives have concentrated on domestic affairs, Burnham, I think, like Barry Goldwater, would have agreed with John F. Kennedy's inaugural address in terms of foreign policy, the liberals continue to praise presidential activism in the domestic scene, reserving their guns for foreign policy. Now, the debate about a strong presidency versus a weak Congress, this is not new in American history. Founding fathers were cognizant of this problem. They were troubled by the powers that they were giving the executive. And from Washington on, the legislature and the executive existed not so much in a state of checks and balance, but in a kind of adversary relationship. There have been several periods, as I said earlier, where Congress was the dominant force and the presidency the weak force, such as the period after the Civil War. Now, Schlesinger Jr., one of the interesting things about his book, about his criticism of the liberalism that he once personified, says very little in a critical way about either of his two heroes, FDR and JFK, the two people who I suspect are more responsible than almost anyone else for increasing presidential power, for allowing, for example, John Ehrlichman to come before the Watergate Committee and say, in effect, the president thinks it's in the national interest to rob a bank, he can do so. He says very little in a critical way about them. For example, he describes Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis with the word brilliant. It is the presidency from Truman on, with the exception of Kennedy, that he rails against, the presidency, he argues, that perceived itself to be the last best hope of human progress. Only through an activist presidency can we get human progress, both at home and abroad. And of course, the things that most disturb him, again, are not the domestic revolutions, but things like the crusade in Europe, the containment of communism, the alliance for progress, the arrogance of Lyndon Johnson coming on television as a kind of tragic and beleaguered man and saying, I am the only president you've got. This is the kind of thing that disturbs Schlesinger Jr. But the real villain of this book, interestingly enough, is a man who I think would have been inconceivable without the kind of advocacy that Schlesinger Jr. and his political heroes had propounded over the years, and that, of course, is Richard Nixon. He is perceived as an American Gaullist by Schlesinger Jr., who used his mandate as a source of wider power than had ever been claimed by a president before. Under this system, in effect, a president is accountable to no one. This is Schlesinger Jr.'s reading, save the voters every 4 years. And yet it seems to me that this is a direction in which the presidency has been going for some years now. Nixon, alas, I hasten to add, is no Charles de Gaulle. He's not even a Georges Pompidou, which I think is perhaps saddest of all. Richard Nixon, purely from his understanding of the presidency, as opposed to his political philosophy, is exactly the kind of strong, determined president that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and his ideological allies have argued for all their lives. He is the great apotheosis of the Jacksonian approach to presidential power. And interesting that this, of course, was a position that Schlesinger Jr. once defended at one time, right down, I hasten to add, to his hatred of the Eastern establishment, something which Andrew Jackson felt very strongly about. However, rather early, he recognized the ideological dangers which a strong presidency, Arthur Sessions Jr., did pose to liberalism. And I think he wrote something in his book, The Vital Center, that again well sums up the predicament of presidential power today, the predicament that liberals and conservatives find themselves in, especially when we recall that at least up until Nixon, most conservatives were rather wary about a big, strong activist president. Sessions Jr. wrote in The Vital Center, "So long as democracy continues, the government will periodically change hands, and every accretion to the power of the state must be accounted as a weapon of a future conservatism, as well as a present liberalism. It is not too much to anticipate that the fortunes of interventionism may duplicate the fortunes of free enterprise, and what began as a faith for liberals end up as a philosophy for conservatives." So, as I say, it all depends on whose ox is being gored. Richard Nixon, without Woodrow Wilson, his hero, incidentally. FDR, Harry Truman, is inconceivable. John Ehrlichman, who, as I mentioned earlier, told the Watergate Committee that the president, in effect, can do anything, just about anything he wants in the name of national interest. I suspect it would ultimately be inconceivable without Arthur Schlesinger Jr., James McGregor Burns, and the rest of that crew, who now find themselves in the position of reevaluating, because, as I say, it all depends on whose ox is being gored, the whole concept of presidential power. Whereas those of us, those conservatives, who during our period in opposition veiled against the increase in presidential power, we find many conservatives today, or people at least used to call themselves conservatives, and used to attend meetings like the Philadelphia Society, defending, or at least defending for a while, Richard Nixon's use of presidential power. Well, I suppose I could go on, but I would rather leave this little talk without actually resolving it and hoping that we can perhaps get into more details during the discussion. Certainly, it seems to me that the growth of presidential power, and I think Nixon has demonstrated this, remains as relevant and thorny an issue for conservatives today as it did during the halcyon days of Franklin Roosevelt. Thank you very much.